This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Boker Tov, can we still say Boker Tov? Yes, Boker Tov. Okay, so my name is Tova Leah Nachmani. I have met many of you before when you've come participated in the Executive Learning Seminar. I've been teaching at Pardes for about 17 years. Just a word about me, that I grew up in Dayton, Ohio, in the cornfields of Dayton, Ohio. I grew up in a fairly assimilated Jewish home with parents who were really tzaddikim, righteous human beings. My father's celebrating his 90th birthday this week. Thank you. And really has lived a life with so much integrity, so well learned. And so I just always want to say that when I mentioned that our house was very assimilated Jewishly, that my parents really... I think taught me all the Jewish values that I then came to seek out in my later years when I came to Israel and I started to become religious, and that whole process that I really sort of felt like I was always just coming back home to the things that my parents, those basic values that my parents always stood for and stood by in their lifetimes. My mother as well, she's deceased, but my mother as well. Really every day my parents' lives was always so fully lived and lived really with just the finest of values. So I just want to make mention of that. I came to Israel. The reason I'm telling you this is because it connects to the idea of risk taking. Okay? I chose this topic, and I'll tell you a tiny bit about myself in the context, because I chose this topic because when I learn Torah, and when I teach Torah, I try to teach it and learn it and study it from a place of personal connection and personal inspiration. And for me, Torah is not an intellectual pursuit as much as I like the academic rigor of learning Torah and everything that that entails. But for me, the Torah is really a pursuit in learning to identify qualities and values that I already behold, and to refine them and to sharpen them and to think about them through a new lenses. So when I think about risk-taking, I can first of all say that there were certainly two types of risk-taking that I did, the kind of risk-taking I did as an adolescent, which was frivolous, coming home after my curfew and all kinds of, drinking, all the things that teenagers do. And there's that kind of risk-taking that a lot of times people do for self-interest, for the thrill, right? Sometimes people take risks. One of the party's board members recently climbed Mount, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, Kilimanjaro? Yeah.
Kilimanjaro.
Yes, you know. Okay. And really, at someone who's older than I am.
Wow.
Is how old? Yeah, really. And so there's certain risks. I mean, I think that's a tremendous risk for somebody who's, not a young kid to be taking. And so I don't think that falls into the category of, like, frivolous risk-taking, but there is a certain sense of thrill. Or someone who runs a marathon, it's really, there's a certain sense of personal, personal aspiration and drive and something that people, so we all take, we take risks for different reasons. And there's a different kind of risk-taking that I identify with in my later years, later meaning post-adolescent years, when I left home to come to Israel for the one-year program and really had no idea what I was getting myself into. This was in the early 1980s, before there were computers, cell phones, and I didn't have a phone at all. I didn't have a landline, not to mention a cell phone. And really, coming to Israel at that time, you couldn't open up on the website. You couldn't get a virtual tour of like anything at that time. You had no idea what you were walking into. And so to come to Israel during those years was really quite a risky time, not in terms of security, but in terms of the kind of risks that it felt like to me to, and I'm sure many of you have had different experiences of your own risk, to leave home, to leave what was familiar to me, to go on a search and to start seeking for something that I didn't really even know what it was. When I was growing up, I had a strong sense of like appreciation for being Jewish, but I didn't know what that meant to me. I didn't know what role Israel played to me in my university days. Before I came on the one-year program, I met an Israeli family, and the father of the family, his name is Uri, and his wife is Rachel, and his father, he was doing a PhD in statistics at Hebrew at the Yale University in Bloomington. His father was one of Ben-Gurion's best friends. And her, and this family that I met when I was in university, her father and brothers and uncles, they were all fighter pilots in the IDF. And most of them had actually been killed in battles, right? And won, you know, medals of courage and bravery and things like that. And so when I met them when I was in university, and they would ask me about Israel and what do I know about Israel, and I really didn't know anything about Israel. And something about that, in those conversations, those ongoing conversations, when I kept saying, well, I really don't know, tell me about that and tell me what happened and tell me what you, and I really had no knowledge whatsoever. Something in that really sparked within me a desire to leave the America that I knew and grew up in, that I felt appreciative for but didn't really relate to in a very deep level. I felt like that in a sense there was no real risk-taking that I had ever learned or had been exposed to for some kind of a greater purpose. And Israel for me was very, very much about that. It was very much about risk-taking for something that I believed in. Leaving my family, leaving my culture, leaving my language, leaving all the things that were familiar to me, leaving in a sense, and in the end I didn't go back to university there. I continued my studies here, but it meant leaving whatever I had already accomplished there. To come and sort of start my life all over again here, eventually, not that one year, but later on. So there's a lot of the topic of risk-taking is very, very dear to my heart. And I want to open by giving you the opportunity on the first page of your source sheet, everyone has it open, to think about in the book of Ruth, which we'll look at very soon, is that both Ruth and Naomi were bold risk-takers. And in essence, we are all risk takers. Some of us more, some of us less. Some researchers say that it has to do with our hormonal balance within us sometimes. That the people have, I'm not going to go into the details of it, you can Google it, but that risk taking may be connected somehow to our hormone count. Okay. But anyway, what I want us to think about is that for whatever reason, we feel ourselves to be more risk takers, less risk takers. I want us to think about a situation where you have personally taken a risk for something you believed in or to which you were committed. Not a frivolous risk, right? But some kind of a risk that you've taken in your lifetime for something which was a greater goal, something that you felt that you believed in. And the question I'm asking is, what were you prepared to lose and what gave you the courage to do so? Because in every risk, there's always loss. Okay? What did you lose if you lost something? And what did you gain? And how long did it take you to appreciate your gain? Because often, in the risk-taking business, we gain a tremendous amount, but we don't see it right away. And it might take a short while, or a long while, or a very long while, until we can really appreciate the things that we've accomplished. So that's what I want to do in the first few minutes now of class, for you to just spend a couple minutes thinking about an example of such, and then turn to the person next to you and share your thoughts on this. Okay? Why don't you take a couple minutes and just make notes to yourself of some experience that you've had, if you'd like to. And each person can take just a couple minutes to tell the person next to them about their risk experience.
Thank you. I'm going to Okay, finish your thoughts, please. The next step in your conversation. Sorry if you're not quite finished. I never exactly gauge when it's the perfect time. When people are sharing things, it's hard to gauge when's the perfect time to bring everyone back together. But I'd like you to turn to the person next to you one more time, and using your combined experiences, I want you to look at the next section on your source sheet, the psychology of risk-taking. What would you say are three things a person must know about risk-taking, about this kind of risk-taking, risking something for something that you believe in or to which you are committed? What are three things a person must know about that kind of risk-taking? So see if you can come up with one or two or three ideas.
Well, awareness of loss, the possibility or the probability of some loss.
Okay, so instead of doing it together, should we just do it as a group?
Yeah.
Yes? Okay, fine. That's fine. It's fine. I was going to do it individually, but that's fine.
So this is the psychology of risk-taking is the probability of loss.
Yes.
Okay, there's going to be a probability. I'm going to write prepare for loss, right? Probability. Maybe even a high probability for loss. Yes.
The gain-risk ratio. I might want to jump out of an airplane with a parachute, have a lot of fun, but the risk that the parachute wouldn't open is the risk. Got to balance.
Okay, good. So that not just for to prepare for loss, but to rationally and logically think through the, how did you call it, the gain?
Gain-risk ratio.
Risk. Ratio. Okay, in other words, that when we're prepared to take a risk or something, we really have to think through and calculate and strategize and prepare for the kind of risk that we are desiring to take, so that we don't just find ourselves in a big mess. Yes.
Based on the things we were talking about, I would say that the risk is important enough to us that we're willing to go for it.
That's right. And so to make sure that the risk is important enough,
that it has to be really important.
Well, that's in the gain risk.
The gain risk, that strategy is more danger. You know, like if it's not things that are going to put you in physical harm, then you got to think about how important is this to you. I mean, you could do it in that way too, but the risk is less.
So you're talking about having basically a greater value. There needs to be a value or a belief or something that you risk yourself for. It needs to be something. What was the word that you used? Something greater than yourself. Is that
or so important? I don't know.
Or something that's important. Greater value, belief, or some right. I mean, I'm assuming that what's important to you is going to be something that you believe
enough
in.
Enough that you are prepared to take the risk.
Right. That it must be very, very important to you, and that is connected to this ratio, because that's really what's going to enable you to take that step forward out of the proverbial airplane. We're not talking necessarily about dangers, but there also could be dangers. There's no question that it's not only a question of loss, but there also could be a probability of danger as well. Yes?
This may fit under one of the other two categories, but what are the variables that are beyond your control possible?
Okay, is that part of the risk ratio?
I wonder if it's there or in the preparedness for loss to a certain extent. It may be both.
So it's basically about considering. I think it's connected to this also about the strategizes. It's really connected maybe to both of them. Right? It's about considering the variables. I think it's part of this, and it's really part of both of these. Very good. I like that, though. It's very more specific. Yes.
Knowing that there will be real periods of uncertainty where you really question, is this the right thing to do? And is this not going to work out? And you just have to go with your best instincts and trust.
That in capital letters, uncertainty, excellent. And that's a very important part of taking risks, is knowing that I don't know how it's going to turn out, and I don't know, and there may be long periods of time where I live within a sense of uncertainty, and yet I still have to keep my, I have to keep my eye on the, right, on the bullseye, as well, like on my aim, and at the same time I'd be living for a very long period of time with a lot of uncertainty. Very, very nice. Okay, who else? Yes.
I think in all the situations you have to have self-knowledge about how you react to different things. You have to know a lot about yourself before you take a certain risk, to know whether you're actually going to have the confidence to get through it or if this is something that you're not. I think a lot of self-understanding, self-knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, you have to know that you're going to be able to actually live through the live through the experience, not turn around and go back, which is also okay. That's also part of a risk, is turning around and deciding, you know, I'm not ready to do that. You can change course. There's no question that that's also a possibility, but I think that's a very, very important piece of before you just jump into it, to have a very clear sense of how, of I would say, your own traits and your own ability and your own sense of courage and your own sense of clarity in what it is that you're going for. Very good, Steve.
The growth comes from risk. I think that understanding that then motivates a person to the willingness to take the risk, because it's a belief that I'm going to grow as a result of taking the risk.
Right, excellent. I would say that it might even be sometimes true that there is no growth if there is no risk. That growth really only comes through a sense of, or I would say maybe the deepest kind of growth can come really only through a sense of risk. Very often, I never want to say always, but I would say that's very important.
In terms of this list, I believe that the core most important issue is greater value of belief, the core value, because if you don't have that, none of the others will follow. So that, I think, should go right to the top.
Core belief. Mm-hmm. So if we were to then prioritize the, so you would say that this would be number one for you.
Yes.
Right. And we're going to talk about that exactly. And that's very much where we're going. Yes.
I think risk always involves a letting go of something, regardless of what you're going to. Something has to be released, and that is going to hurt someone. Mm-hmm. And so the ability to live with that hurt, knowing that someone has in some way been either left behind, or you don't have the same time for them, or someone is going to hurt, and you have to live with that.
Very beautiful, right? Very much so. Yes?
I think you actually have to define risk, because risk can be any movement, any decision, mm-hmm. and people who can't move, are immobilized by fear, find that as they're overwhelmed by risk. By not making a decision, they're still making a decision. Mm-hmm. And that's what you have to teach them in order for them to then be able to make some other decision. So I think jumping out of a plane, walking on a cliff, I mean, that's that sort of thrill-seeking thing. But if you define risk as, you know, shall I do this at university or that? Shall I marry this guy or that guy or whatever? That's a sort of a, I think, that risk needs to be broken up into different compartments.
Yes.
Because you can define it as everything. I can define it as everything.
That's right. Almost everything you do involves making choices and taking risks.
Yeah.
And at the same time, many risks are, some of them involve loss and some of them involve danger. So I think that we could be preparing for a loss, or we could be preparing for danger. And in the very beginning, the way that I defined it, or I described it, was that there's certain things that we do for self-serving purposes, mm-hmm. for the thrill, and I'm not really talking about that kind of risk in this class. And that's also kind of risk and risk-taking, and there's a whole another class we could give about that. But here I'm really talking about the kind of risk, as you said, which is for the sake of something, for a value or for a belief, and something that, yes, could include danger, could involve danger,
or loss, or both, right? But this is the kind of risk that I'm thinking about, not risk that would just for the thrill of it. Yes. Thank you for that, Tom.
You have to commit a certain amount of time to your risk.
Very good. Okay, so you need to
be dedicated to investing the amount of time, energy, thought.
Right, to take in that next step.
Last but not least,
placed in your list for a commitment to not going back. But that can be a trap. I could always do something else, or I could always go back. So I think that's important.
A commitment to not going back. Sasha, I said the opposite before, and I'm glad you brought that up, because I said it's possible to go back, because it depends what it is that we're. It depends what it is. It depends what our value and our belief is, because sometimes it is possible and even okay to go back, and in other times when I'm making a decision, I need to say, and I think that marriage is a good example of this. Of course, unless things don't work out, like in retrospect, things could happen. But I'm saying that when a person, I just talked to my young Parday students about this, about walking into a commitment. What does it mean to make a commitment? Making a commitment means that this is for life, and there is no going back. And if something happens in the future, then we can talk about that. Something which is really extraneous that happens in the future, that's very not extraneous. What was what I meant to say? Extreme. Happens in the future, right? That's a different conversation. But when we go into something, that yes, it is. When I decide that I'm not going back, and there is no going back, then I can proceed forward with whatever challenges. And I think marriage is a good example of this. Whatever challenges that I'm faced, then I know that I'm going to be facing those challenges and confronting them and working with them, and not going to be turning my back and going the other way. And again, unless I don't mean to. I just want to say in parentheses that anyone who's chosen otherwise in terms of leaving a marriage, I don't mean to say that in a sense of right to judge anyone who's made an important choice, because everyone makes their own choice for their own reasons, but I just think that that's when we start out in a relationship, that's what it's about.
And should a marriage sadly come to a point where divorce is the best option, that's not actually going back, that's going forward, and dealing, as you said, dealing with a situation that perhaps didn't pertain at the earlier time.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, ready to move?
It seems like a lot of what we've spoken about presumes failure, so I think it's also important to have a vision of success and what that actually would look like, because very often, particularly with the marriage example, a successful marriage, from what I've been told, is not based on simply making it to, the chuppah and that's it. It's actually a continual process. So what that means in terms of your engagement after that turning point.
I appreciate that so much. That would have been sorely missing from our list if you hadn't brought it up. Definitely, to prepare for success is the ability to look at that thing which I want, which I value so much. It's not just having the value and belief, but actually believing in myself and in the people that I'm collaborating with, hopefully, that we can make it happen. One other thing I would add here, which I think I wanted to have up here, is that the psychology of risk-taking is that when we believe in something which is a value or which is beyond ourselves, so it's very common and I think helpful to seek out people to collaborate with, to work as a team. Right? And when we work as a team, part of preparing for success is also finding, right, seeking out
comrades,
right, team players, people to collaborate with, and not trying to do things by ourselves. We're going to take this conversation into the Book of Ruth. Who is that?
It's my mother's daughter.
Okay. Let's just remind ourselves to turn our cell phones down or off. I'll do the same. Thank you for the reminder. So we all need to take. It's okay. It could have happened to any of us. My cell phone is also not off. Great. Thank you, Bill, for that reminder for every one of us. Okay, good. We just need to make these, Rav Meir, can we just make these name ties a little bit shorter next time? Because I like to call people by name, and I say like you and you because you're tags are under the table, so I only like them close enough to be able to call them by name, not that we've actually ever moved. Right? Okay, good. So now I'm going to give you a short amount of time to read a few excerpts from Megillat Ruth, from the Megillat Book of Ruth. And what I'd like for us to do, I'll just walk you through the instructions on your first page of your source sheet. And you have the Book of Ruth in the very beginning of your notebook. Okay? But I'd just like for you to look at it with me. We're going to take a very brief look at Megillat Ruth. You see where it says Charuta in the middle of your page on your source sheet? So read Megillat Ruth. That's not the whole thing. I don't want you to read all of Megillat Ruth. What I want you to do is, we're really, if you go down two paragraphs, it says read Ruth chapter 3. That's really what we're getting at. But I just want you to, I want to lay it out so that we don't spend a time reading things that are not going to be relevant for us. Read Megillat Ruth at a glance, meaning the pieces that I'm giving you, to read them at a glance, with an eye on the risk-taking strategies, potential losses, and gains of Naomi, Ruth, and Boaz, as suggested below. Okay? The next paragraph, I'm just going to read it out loud because I'm not sure that it is totally clear, but it's just a piece of background. Okay? You can look at it in the text itself. You can also skip it and go on to chapter 3. 3 months have gone by between Ruth's first gleaning from the fields of Boaz, which is in Ruth chapter 1, verse 22, to the end of the wheat harvest, which is Ruth 2, verse 23. And just for you to know that how much time really elapses, because the Megillah doesn't tell you how much time elapses. So as soon as, right when Naomi starts to panic, I might say, and be concerned about Ruth's future security, and want to send her down to the threshing floor where Boaz is for him to redeem her and hopefully marry her, then the question is, why is she so stressed out? Is like a shidduch stress? Is she just like, was she panicking about a shidduch for her daughter? And just, it's important to know that in Israel, the barley harvest begins the day after the first day of Pesach. And the wheat harvest begins nearly 6 weeks later, around Shavuot, lasting for roughly 6 weeks. So 12 weeks, right, divided by 4 is 3 months. And just so for us to understand that there are roughly, commenters say that there are roughly 3 months that go by between Ruth's first gleaning from the fields of Boaz to the time when Naomi starts to get nervous and say, wait a minute, I'm going to like make this plan, and I think you really should go down to the threshing floor and make sure that you're going to have somebody to take care of you. Okay, so Ruth's been around for a while, and Naomi, they've been back in the land of Israel, in the land of Judah, which is in our area. 10 minutes south of here is the entrance to Bethlehem. Okay? That's Beit Lechem Yehuda. That's where the Book of Ruth takes place. Right, mamash, here. 10 minutes south of where we are now. You go up there at Hebron, and you drive 10 minutes south, and you're in Bethlehem. Right? So it's right here, this right place. So the place where they had come back to from Moab, which is modern-day Jordan, right? Come back here. So they've come back home to their community. Naomi has come back home to her community after, as we know, her husband and her sons died. Right? We know that Naomi has two daughters-in-law who she begs for them to go back to their families. The sages tell us that those women, Ruth and Orpah, came from royal lineage. I'm just going to throw that in because that has something a lot to do with what they were prepared, or at least what Ruth was prepared to lose by coming along with Naomi.
Okay? Had she not already lost that by marrying?
Had she lost that
Naomi
by marrying? She had moved away from her family. Had she lost it, I think she could. I mean, if the fact that Naomi tells her to go back, just go back to your families, go back, find a husband. And I don't think that they have been cut off from their families, based on what we read in the first chapter of the Megillah. Okay?
Do we know what happened to Orpah later?
No. Okay. I don't know.
Disappeared.
She disappears. She's not. She's a character. She walks off stage, and we're not interested in her. So what I want you to do, therefore, in Charuta for the next few minutes, is to read Ruth chapter 3.
Wasn't she the mother of Goliath?
Midrash, we're not going to go there now. Stay focused on Ruth and Naomi. So I'm going to ask you the third little paragraph under the word Charuta. It says, read Ruth chapter 3. Okay? And that's going to be the scene where Naomi sends Ruth all dressed up and showered and perfumed and everything right down to the threshing floor at night. okay? Mm-hmm. At the end of the harvest season. Okay, and I want you to, just from that paragraph, read chapter 3. And on your source sheets, you're going to be looking at this page and the following page, which is a few different midrashim and psalms, actually two psalms and a midrash. Okay? It's all laid out in your instructions. You're going to be reading Ruth chapter 3 with my instructions and taking a look at the psalms and the midrash on the following page. That's it. Okay? So I'm going to give you, I think, 20 minutes to do that. It won't take you more than that, and then we'll come together and discuss. So you can turn to the person next to you and learn. If anyone prefers to learn on their own, that's also okay, I think. No, okay, for days, but you can choose to learn as you want. We're going to learn in here 20 minutes. 20 minutes. It's a long time. I don't recommend that you go to the Beit Midrash for this, only because... Oh, that store is excellent. Good. That's a great idea. Okay. Anyone who would like to can go next door. You can spread out their other spaces to learn. Okay. So what do you want to say? Ruth and Naomi both took risks in this endeavor. Ruth clearly was a... Naomi... Clearly must have been a very special woman to set up her daughter-in-law in such a high-risk situation. We may look upon her with critique, which we're allowed to have. But at the same time, I want to take us back to the very beginning of the conversation that she had with Ruth when she, after Ruth's husband had died, Naomi's sons, when Naomi was trying to convince Ruth to go back, she says, I don't have anyone for you to marry in chapter 1. You didn't read it. I'm just filling you in. I don't have anyone for you to marry. Even if I was to get pregnant today. In other words, why does she even say that? Because she certainly is concerned for Ruth's security, but why else does she say that? Because it's not... I mean, you think that... That was manipulation. Naomi really wanted Ruth to come back with her. Naomi really did not want Ruth to come back with her. Why? What would have been the problem? And what was the problem of Ruth's coming back to the land of Israel?
She had no one to protect her.
Yes. She had no one to protect her. And she was a Moabite. That's right. And she was a Moabite. And Moabites were not welcome in the community of Israel. It went, right? And so it's not like she could come back and just find her a shidduch, right? And at the marketplace or in her own family, it was not a simple thing. And maybe the reason why she did not go directly to Boaz was because we were talking about a regular person, even though in the commentaries and the sages tell us that when Ruth says to Naomi, Amech ami ve'elohaich elohai, your people are my people and your God is my God, some commentators say she converted, that she actually was a convert. But if she was a convert, I'm not so sure that it still needed to be such a difficult situation. I think it's perhaps more helpful for us to imagine her not having converted, but rather when she said, your people are my people and your God is my God, to me that says something very, very powerful about Naomi. What did Ruth see in Naomi's home that made her say that? Ruth was her daughter-in-law. What did she see? Why did Ruth, she could have gone back, Ruth could have gone back to her royal family and lived happily ever after with her Prince Charming, and it would have all worked out. What do you think she saw in Naomi's home, in the home of her mother-in-law, that made her say that?
She couldn't go back to her family her, because she wouldn't have been accepted then.
So I want to take the stand that based on the shot of the text, she didn't convert. But she actually didn't convert, but she had married somebody who was outside of her, right, outside of her own people. And yet at the same time, like I said before, Naomi tells her to go back to her family, which I think is an indication for us that she did have contact with her family, that she wouldn't have been ostracized. So the question is, what do you think she saw in Naomi's home? David said spirituality. What do you mean?
Well, we assume that, that Naomi was a...
Just speak up a little bit, yeah?
We assume that Naomi was a God-fearing, good person.
Mm-hmm.
And the standards that she set, and the way she lived her life, Ruth found a model for herself.
Absolutely. So when we think about the character of Naomi, I think it's important for us to think about who she was in the eyes of Ruth. Who was she? She was somebody that was a model for Ruth, a model of who knows what exactly, but integrity. We don't need a GPS. We're here. His GPS just went off. Okay. That she was a model of integrity. Perhaps she was a model of spirituality. Perhaps she was God-fearing. Maybe it was just, I don't know if you ever had, good cook. I think that would not have been enough, right? I don't know if you ever had an experience. I remember my early days when I had experience of being in someone's house for Shabbat. For me, that was a turning point. Before I ever knew what Shabbat was, really, I was in someone's house for Shabbat, and I saw it Friday night, and I saw their candles lit, and they were sitting around a table, and they were singing songs together. I mean, teenagers and adults were singing songs together. For me, that was like, what? I never seen that before. Right? We always had a joke in our household that when my father would sing, that and actually, I called my father last night. I told you he was celebrating his 90th birthday. I called him last night. We spoke to him last night on the phone, and I started to sing Happy Birthday, and he said to me, don't sing, because he's joking at our family joke that whenever anybody used to sing, we would say, don't sing, like, that's embarrassing. It's not cool. It's not whatever. So when I like for me to see this family who sitting around their table and sharing ideas with each other, and right, and as wonderful as my family was, there was something about that which really sparked in me a sense of, I want something of that, right? And that was many years ago. So I can imagine, maybe I'm just projecting, but I can imagine that Ruth may have seen something spiritual and also ethical in her household that she was very attracted to. Yes?
And it might have been that Ruth was really young when she married, because in the chapter that we just read, Boaz refers to her as my daughter, which to me is implying that he's older.
That,
so even though she's been 10 years with her first husband and now sojourn with Naomi, she still is really young.
That's true. She's also young in the eyes of I mean, she's not like 20.
Right.
Meaning, right, but she is certainly young and much younger than Boaz. Boaz is already, right, an upstanding
figure. Right, so she might have been young and naive when she first came into the household with Naomi and therefore saw things that she didn't.
Right, and even if she wasn't young and naive and hadn't grown up in a royal palace, she still saw things that for her were different and more meaningful and that right, really tugged at her heartstrings. Yeah.
I think
Naomi
must have treated her nicely. Mary. As a daughter-in-law who came from a place where Naomi really didn't know that she was actually, committed to Judaism, it seems that she was, she would have been taken back by her son's marriage, although her husband left her in Moab, so I
right.
But yes. She would have been taken aback by her husband's marrying somebody who was that weak old. But she must have treated her with respect.
Beautiful, right? As a mother-in-law, that she actually like probably went above and beyond the call of duty for those daughter-in-laws, where she could have shown her, right? She could have given her a cold shoulder because she was a Moabite and because their children really did not marry within the fold, within the tribe, which was very, very important at the time. So I think that that's a very important point. But, yes?
Even how she talks to her daughters after she buries a husband and two sons. First of all, she calls them daughters, not daughters-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
And she seems sincerely concerned about their well-being. Go back to a place where you belong. Go to your real mother's. It's with tremendous compassion.
Beautiful.
And also just thinking how devastating for Naomi to deal with the loss of husband and sons. And maybe Ruth saw something in how Naomi was handling this tragedy, that she still had a spark of life in her, that Ruth said, I want to be part of a people who's able to move forward.
Beautiful. I love that idea. Very beautiful. So for all of these reasons, we can really hold, before we go to the threshing floor, and think about the risks that that Naomi sort of pushed Ruth into taking. I think that there's a very good reason to have this deep respect for Naomi, and at the same time, I want to ask, tell me about the risk. What was she risking? What was Naomi risking? What was Ruth risking by not resisting? She could have. She knew how to say no to her mother-in-law. Right?
Ruth was risking her reputation.
Yes, Ruth was risking her reputation, and what could have happened? Let's play it out. What could have happened in that community?
She could have been ostracized.
She could have been ostracized, exactly. She could have been ostracized by her community. I don't know if at that point people, if she could have been expelled, I don't know, but I think that really for Ruth's reputation, also Naomi's, or you
yes,
were saying...
Yes, because they were just coming round to accepting Ruth,
right.
as a first part of the community.
Right, exactly.
And now this thing has happened, and they think, oh, you know, she's a slut or whatever.
Right, very much so. She could have lost her reputation. She could have lost her reputation also. They both could have been ostracized. And I don't know. And I don't know if Ruth could have been, you know, deported back to Moab. Mm-hmm. But certainly, there was that was probably the biggest risk. Yes.
She might have been putting herself in physical danger.
That's right. So there's no question that Naomi was putting Ruth, and Ruth was putting herself in physical danger. Boaz at the threshing floor, as much as he was, Naomi says in the text, she says that I know that Boaz won't be settled until he does the right thing. I know that there's Ruth. We know that Naomi trusted Boaz tremendously. And he was an upstanding person. And we see in the end of the story also, in chapter 4, we see how Boaz takes responsibility. And so we see who he is. And yet, in the Talmud it says that ein apotropos la'ariot, that even a great person, even great people can fall prey to temptation. And exactly, he had been eating, he had been drinking, he was very satisfied, it was late at night, right? And clearly he could have taken advantage of, obviously he could have taken advantage of Ruth, but not only could he have taken advantage of her, maybe what Naomi was expecting is that he would have had intimate relations with her, and then said, oops, I really need to marry this woman. And said, oops, I'm going to need to marry this woman.
Or
maybe
not.
That's what...
Or not.
Or, exactly, and that was the other risk. Is maybe what Naomi was expecting was that even if he was going to be intimate with her, either she trusted him and thought, no, he's not that type of person. And then I want to say, but maybe he also, but there's always, that was the risk involved, that he could have been tempted by her, he could have actually had intimate relations with her, and then he could have denied the whole thing. He could have denied it, and he could have just, you know, pushed her away, and she could have been ostracized, and he had enough status and enough clout in the community that he could have done whatever he wanted to do, okay? And so I think that both of them were taking tremendous risks in this situation. Why do you think that Naomi didn't go directly to Boaz and just ask him?
Maybe she was...
Take responsibility, Shoshana?
Wasn't somebody else, some other person supposed to redeem her? So
yes,
why
there
did
is
she
some...
go to him in the first place?
Right, right.
Why was she trying to do that?
Right, there was somebody who was a closer kinsman who could have redeemed.
I'm
not going to go into the details of that, but yes, there was somebody closer, and they call him in the text.
What's
his name? What's his name? Tloni.
But that was after this happened.
That's right, after this happened. And so I think that it was because she trusted, I'm guessing because she trusted Boaz so deeply that she expected that Boaz was going to do the right thing. And clearly Ploni, when he had the opportunity to redeem, right, to marry her, he said, no, I don't want to have any part of it, which is why he gets why he doesn't get a name. That's why he's called Ploni.
If Boaz had had relations with her while the other guy didn't say, I don't want her, what would have been the implications of that?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer. Mayor, do you know what the implications would have been?
That would have been it.
She would have been.
She would have been to Boaz.
She would have?
Been to Boaz.
Would it belong to Boaz if they had relations? In other words, even though they circumvented, which I was asking, even though they circumvented Ploni.
Oh,
okay. So, yes.
I don't think Naomi would have gone to Boaz because I think given what we know, he might have said, I'm too old, I don't want to get involved in this, you know, I'm over this. And I think that the way she played it out was more subtle, so it allowed it to emerge rather than to confront it directly on.
Yes, absolutely. She was strategizing. She was strategizing for that because she actually knew that the answer was going to be no. I think that that's why she didn't go to him directly. Yes, David and Lenore.
Had she gone to Boaz, she would have been the initiator. She must have been embarrassed by her downfall. She says as much.
Mm-hmm,
her poverty
mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
her downfall.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
This way, he is seen as the first mover.
Excellent.
And so she is spared any embarrassment.
Right. Someone mentioned before, right, this self-knowledge, and that a person needs confidence in order to take a risk. And on one hand, there was a certain amount of confidence that Naomi had. On the other hand, Naomi didn't have such a strong self-esteem. Because why? She had left her community during a time of famine when they had enough
the means to be able to support lots of people.
And going to Moab, which was an alien place.
And going to Moab, even though the question is where else would they have gone? Egypt, would that have been better? It's not so clear, but it seems like they're the only ones going to Moab. How come nobody else went to Moab? Did you ever think about that? Why were they the only family that went to Moab? And everyone else served? Well, we don't hear about a famine killing out, right, wiping out the tribe of Judah. So apparently the famine was great, but it wasn't so great that people ended up not being able to. So the fact that they left, Naomi was embarrassed by it, right? And she says that God has punished me for what we did. That's what she says when she comes back. She says, right, my fate is bitter because God has punished me for the things that we did. She took upon herself and she recognized what she had done. So I think that's a very important point, that she wanted Boaz to be the initiator. She didn't have the confidence to believe that she really even deserved for him to say yes. And last but not least,
I think also, dare I say, in a patriarchal culture, women can't be so direct.
I don't think you have to dare to say it. I think that's right for sure. I think that it's much more common for women to need to work right behind the scenes and not around the system is a good way of putting it. Beautiful. Okay?
Yeah.
Ready? We're going to take the next step. On page 3 of your source sheet. See at the top of page 3, it says Kabbalistic traits for risk taking. Oh, actually, no, I wanted to go over page 2 first. I'm sorry. I wanted to go over page 2. In the Psalms, who got to the page 2 with the Psalms? Did you read that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, King David, who is a descendant of right, Ruth and Boaz, that's the end of the book of Ruth. Right, that ultimately that King David is a descendant of them, and it says that King David, I'm in the middle of page 2, at midnight I get up to acknowledge you for your righteous judgments. I attach myself to all who are filled with awe of you and to those who guard your precepts. Your steadfast loving kindness, O God, fills the earth. Teach me your laws. For what did he feel immense gratitude, says the Midrash below, Midrash El Kuchimoni. Everybody see on page 2, the bottom of the page, everybody see it? Scripture stated, as at midnight it will rise to show gratitude unto you for your righteous judgments, quoting King David. Said David, at midnight I must rise to show gratitude unto you for what you have done for my grandfather, in other words, my ancestor, not literal grandfather, and grandmother in the middle of the night. In the middle of the night is a turning point, right? At midnight, it's a time of turning point. It's not, you know, the Cinderella story. We turn it to a pump. And I guess it could go either way. It's a time of risk. It's a time of saying that it's really not so clear how it's going to go. As it is said, it happened at midnight that the man was startled and taken aback, for he suddenly realized there was a woman lying at his feet. Had he hurled a single curse word at her, from where would I, King David, have arisen? But he, God, placed it into his, Boaz's heart, to bless her. So he blessed her, blessed be you to the Lord, my daughter, which shows that he's a God-fearing person. He was not looking to take advantage of her intimately. Your latest act of loyalty is even greater than the first, in that you have not sought after the young men, whether poor or rich. In other words, you could have had, right, looked to hook up with all kinds of young men who are not part of the tribe, who are not redeeming us. What is he saying? Is that as much as Naomi was interested really in providing security for Ruth, Ruth was dedicated to redeeming the family plot, to being able to stay close to Naomi, because if she had just married anyone else, let's say she had been accepted, and that's a question of really would she have been accepted or would she have not been accepted, maybe not easily, but maybe she would have been accepted and been able to marry someone. But if she had married someone else from a different tribe, that would have taken her away from Naomi. And she wanted to stay close to Naomi, and she wanted to stay part of Naomi's family in terms of right, being part of the tribe that she was a part of. Next page, page 3. I'm going to reroute this part of the flight, okay? And I'm not going to study this page with you just because I'd rather spend our time doing something else, I'd rather spend our time getting through the rest of the source sheet, and I'll just mention to you something that you can then go back and take a look at on your own. There are two traits. There are two Kabbalistic traits that belong to the Sefirot, the emanations, and the Kabbalistic ideas of the emanations, which are taught in, I don't study Kabbalah, and I'm not
but I studied Hasidic, studied Hasidic writings for many years, and the two traits of Netzach and Hod are two traits that are considered to be like the two legs through which the divine presence reaches the earth. Okay? There were two columns. See, it says below, it says that there are two columns in the temple, representing the trait King Solomon made in the temple. See where it says Joseph of Jigatilia, 13th century Spain, that representing the trait King Solomon made in the temple, second column, and called it Boaz. Interesting. Boaz. There were two columns, Yachin and Boaz. I'm on page 3 at the top. There were two columns in the temple, Yachin and Boaz, and the Kabbalistic explanation is learned from the verse. His, God's legs are pillars of marble set in sockets of fine gold from Shir HaShirim. These legs are Netzach and Hod. In brief, at the top of the page, you see the word Netzach. What does Netzach mean in Hebrew? It means eternity. It also means to win, right? Netzach is about determination, having a vision of success, knowing that you're going to be victorious, knowing that you have an aim, and that's the right thing to do, and that's what God wants you to do, and that's exactly that. Netzach is something which is eternal, something which doesn't change, something which is certain. That's Netzach, okay? Hod is the flip side of that coin, which is even when you know that you want to be doing something which is the right thing to do, even when you're prepared to take a risk because there's a greater value and belief that you believe in and it's important to you, and you know that you're willing to strategize and to lay out the gain-risk ratio, right? And to know that there may be losses along the way, probability of losses. Hod is this. Hod is the ability to know that there's going to be periods of uncertainty in your process. There is no growth, perhaps, without risk. And if you imagine, even though you can't quite see me and I don't have a ladder, but imagine climbing up the rungs of a ladder. If I want to grow, and right, and I want to, whatever it is I want to do, try to strive. So to put my foot on the next rung, if I want to get up, what do? I have one foot in the air, and I'm right on one leg. And so that's the uncertainty. I did that so you would remember. I thought that. Right, so that just to remember that on one hand, I know where my sights are set. I know where I want to go. I know where I want to climb. But in order to climb, I have to be willing to also be in a situation of uncertainty, instability, and to know that it's not always going to work out exactly the way that I want it to work out. Okay, that's basically the tension between Netzach and Hod, having an idea that I want to work for, and also knowing that there's an uncertainty in the process and it may not work out at the pace or in the way that I exactly want it to work out. We're going to go to the next page and understand this in light of Jewish history. I want to use our time to take a step in this next the next step of what I want to talk about, and I want to leave time at the very end to talk a little bit about Hanukkah as well. Okay, this is why I'm leaving this page of the Kabbalistic things, but we can do that another time. So on page 4 of your source sheet, the attribute of Netzach really belongs to God. It doesn't belong entirely to human beings. Because really only God can be victorious with certainty. Because Netzach is being certain about what the victory is about. It's about, right, knowing, setting your sights. But really, with God, there's no uncertainty, as it were. The divine attribute of Netzach we can see in the writings of Jeremiah. Okay? Jeremiah's writing during one of the most difficult times of Jewish history. Okay? I'm just going to read from my notes for a moment about Jeremiah's background. The great prophet Jeremiah lived during the most crucial period of Judah's existence as a kingdom. Okay, Judah, the lower kingdom of Israel, when it was two kingdoms. Jeremiah saw the destruction, I'm just reading my own notes, it's not on your source sheet. Jeremiah saw the destruction of Jerusalem and the Holy Temple. Jeremiah also tried to prepare the Jewish people for not having to experience a destruction, because he believed that the Jewish people would mend their ways, that the destruction was not inevitable, but in fact they could prevent the destruction of the temple. but the people didn't listen to him. So he saw the destruction happen, right? He saw Jeremiah as the one who wrote the Book of Lamentations. He, even though he warned the Jewish people, once Jerusalem was destroyed, he was at one with the Jewish people, and he identified and empathized with their suffering and with their sorrow. Okay? He also critiqued them because he believed that they could have prevented it. And the book of Echa shows us how connected he was in his heart to the Jewish people. If you look at the source, Jeremiah, in the book of Jeremiah, chapter 29, can someone else read? Someone read it for us? This is the text. And I'll stop you occasionally. Who wants to read?
This is the text of the letter which the prophet Jeremiah sent to Jerusalem, to the priests, to the prophets, to the rest of the elders of the exiled community, and to all the people whom Nebuchadnezzar had exiled from Jerusalem to Babylon.
Okay, from the people who were exiled from the, apparently from the northern community by Assyria, and also the people from the southern kingdom who Nebuchadnezzar had exiled from Jerusalem to Babylon. And here's what he said to them, right? Here's his message to them. Keep reading.
Thus said the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, to the whole community which I exiled from Jerusalem to Babylon. Build houses and live in them, plant gardens and eat their fruit, take wives and beget sons and daughters, and take wives for your sons, and give your daughters to husbands, that they may bear sons and daughters. Multiply there, do not decrease, and seek the welfare of the city to which I have exiled you, and pray to the Lord in its behalf, for in its prosperity you shall prosper.
Stop 1 second. What's Jeremiah doing?
He's
encouraging them. He's basically saying, don't lose faith, don't lose hope. They've been through a destruction. They've been through the most horrendous experience of their lifetimes that they could ever have imagined. They're in Babylon, and he says, don't lose hope. Okay?
Vision of success.
Exactly. He's giving them I think it's helping to give them, yes, a vision of success in the midst of their uncertainty, because they're living uncertainty. So they might say, maybe we shouldn't get settled here. Maybe we shouldn't build houses. Maybe we shouldn't marry. Maybe we should just wait until things settle down. Maybe we should not go on. He says, no, live your life just the way that you're living your life, that you lived your life before. Live your life there also in exile, and continue to build, and continue to, not only that, but continue to pray to the Lord on behalf of the country you're living in. For its prosperity, right? In its prosperity, you will prosper. Thank you for that. Someone else read for us? Thus says, yes.
Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, let not the prophets and diviners in your midst deceive you, and pay no heed to the dreams you dream. For they prophesy falsely to you in my name. I did not send them, declares the Lord.
So these would be prophets and people, prophets of doom, who would be saying, no, it's all over, it's all lost. You might as well assimilate. You're never going back to the land of Israel. You might, right? So those are, he's saying, don't listen to them. Keep going.
Thus says the Lord, when Babylon's 70 years are over, I will enact the promise I made, and I will fulfill to you my promise to bring you back to this place.
To the place meaning to Israel.
Mm-hmm. For I am mindful of the plans I have made concerning you, declares the Lord. They are plans for your welfare, not for disaster, to give you a hopeful future. Mm-hmm. When you call to me and come and pray to me, I will give heed to you. You will search for me and find me. If you will seek me wholeheartedly, I will be there for you, declares the Lord, and I will restore your fortunes. And I will gather you from all the nations and from all the places to which I have banished you, declares the Lord, and I will bring you back to the place from which I have exiled you.
That's Netzach. God's saying, I have a plan, I'm going to carry it out. I can't tell you exactly how long it's going to take. It's going to be a process. There's going to be uncertainty in the process, but you can know that you can count on me. What he's saying. You know you can count on me. Don't lose hope. Don't lose your Jewish identity. Don't stop seeking me. Don't think I've abandoned you, says God to the Jewish people via Jeremiah. And that's the divine attribute of Netzach. It's very difficult for human beings to hold on to that. The human weakness in Netzach, in our inability to really hold on to that vision, is expressed in Midrash Genesis Rabbah. Who wants to read for us? Who would like to read this? Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachman, yes.
For I am mindful of the plans I have made concerning you.
Right, quoting what we just read from Jeremiah, saying that you may have lost hope, you may have think that I abandoned you, but I, God, am mindful of the plans that I've made. I haven't forgotten the promise to you. That's what they're quoting. Go ahead.
The tribal ancestors were engaged in selling Yosef. Yosef was preoccupied with his sackcloth and fasting. Reuben was preoccupied with his sackcloth and fasting. Yaakov was preoccupied with his sackcloth and fasting. While all this was happening, Yehuda was preoccupied with taking a wife. And the Holy One, blessed be He, was engaged in creating the light of the Messiah.
Who can tell us something about this source? What does it have to do with what we're reading?
Yehudan Tamar.
Yehudan Tamar, say more.
So they begot
Peretz.
Correct.
Right, yes, Peretz. That's right. Right, and Peretz is the line of the Mashiach, which is right King David's ancestor. Mm-hmm. And he's saying even through the most horrific of situations, of circumstances, when everybody was mourning, right, after Yosef was sold, right, Yosef was upset, and Reuven was upset because he felt took responsibility for it, and Yaakov, the father, was preoccupied with his fasting because his son had been taken away from him. And while all this was happening, it says, Vayerad Yehuda, in the Torah, there's like a detour that the Torah takes and says that Yehuda went down, right, and he went down, and he actually had relations with a prostitute in Tamar, who was his daughter-in-law, and the whole story, which I'm not going to go into now, but some of you
tomorrow,
are familiar with it.
Tomorrow they will go into it.
Oh, you're going to learn about it? Great, so I won't say any more about it. Thank you, Mayor. And, okay, and he's saying that that whole, what looked like a recipe for disaster, and everybody was sure that it was all over, and there was nothing to be optimistic about. He said, even in that situation, God doesn't forget His promise. God was busy in creating the light of the Messiah. In other words, that God has a plan, and God doesn't forget about His plan. And if God doesn't forget about the plan, what does that mean about us? Take a look at your last page. We have a daily affirmation of Netzach in our prayers, because we do forget about the plan. Or maybe so that we won't forget about the plan, but because it's hard for us to hold on to that, because we live in a world of uncertainty. We live in a world of duality. We live in a world where, right, evil people are breathing down our necks, and it's right, and we live in a world where we don't know what's going to happen. And so we have in our prayer three times a day a reminder of the trait of Netzach. In the first blessing of the Amidah, for which a person must have Kavanah, for this first, right, if you didn't, you kind of like, look, we space out for the rest of the Amidah. It's not good, but it's not the end of the world. But we have to have Kavanah for the first blessing. What do we say in the first blessing? Right? Blessed are you, Hashem, God of our ancestors. And at the top of page 5, God of Avram, God of Yitzchak, and God of Yaakov, who all had their trials and tribulations. The God who is great, mighty, and awesome, the highest power, showering acts of loving kindness, possessing all. Meaning that God is like has things under, that created everything. It has things under, I don't say under control, but working with a certain plan, remembering the kindness of the ancestors, the kindness, the acts of chesed of the ancestors, perhaps including the ancestors of Ruth and Naomi and their kindnesses and Boaz, and bringing a redeemer to their descendants, bringing a redeemer to their descendants, that's us, for the sake of His name, God's name, or God's reputation, with love. In other words, when somebody loves you, even if they don't give you what you want right now, and we have this very often with parents and children, where children want something right now, it's like, I love you, and it's coming, but not yet. It's going to take time, where you may need to earn it. And if you don't, right, and if you're strong enough, you can earn it, that's great. If you don't earn it, I'll help you along. Whatever, right, that's the idea. Blessed be Hashem, shield of Abraham, Magen Avraham. That's our daily affirmation of Netzach, that God does protect Abraham and Abraham's descendants, and that there is a plan, as Jeremiah said, that I'm mindful of you, that there actually is a plan, that there is some long-term plan. I think it's maybe in the 21st century very different to be giving a class like this than it would have been in the Middle Ages. I don't know how, sometimes I ask myself, I don't know how certain people like Rashi and Ramban had the kind of faith that they had with what they were going through. It's very, I personally am at an advantage because I live in a period of time which we're blessed to have a state of Israel and to live in a period of time where, right, we're the kind of things that we're witnessing, even though we also are experiencing trials and tribulations, I feel a whole different sense of being able to say that. And at the same time, there are lots of, like I said, people breathing down our necks, and it's not so simple, and it's not that, you know, The game isn't over, and we're not so sure how things are going to turn out. We're not so sure what tomorrow is going to bring, and we have, right, Hamas here and Hezbollah there and Iran here, and like, right, it's not so pashut, right? It's not so simple. The Zohar Chadash on the Book of Ruth says, quoting Boaz, "Stay here this night, leaving halayla, v'yav boker im gaalech to yigal, v'im lo yechpatz v'gaalech, v'gaaltich anachi Chai Hashem Shichavi Adavokir." He says to Ruth, "Stay here this night, and it will be in the morning that if he will redeem you well." I'm sorry, that's not in the threshing floor. Take that back. Nachon, is it? Yes, it is in the threshing floor. He says that it will be in the morning that if he will redeem you, yes, well, and if he will not redeem you, then I, Boaz, will redeem you, as God lives. That's an oath. Lay down until the morning. Right, don't. He's telling Ruth not to be afraid. In reference to this, the Zohar says that the Holy One, blessed be He, said to the congregation of Israel, "Your latest acts of kindness is greater than your first." In other words, not to follow the young men, whether they are poor or rich. "And that you have remained committed and faithful to me," God saying to the Jewish people in exile. Does it make sense where he's taking this? "And that you paid no heed to the reviling and mocking of the rest of the nations." In other words, it's very easy to say focus on our vision of success and our idea and our aims and our goals and our beliefs. What happens when everybody around us is saying, "Oh, that's ridiculous and that's stupid, and if you believe that way, right, you're going to, right, I don't know, we're going to fight you, or you're going to be executed, or whatever it is, or that's ridiculous, whatever it is." He's saying, don't worry about the rest of the nations who are considered to be the young men, that we're not following after them. Stay here this night. The Zohar that reads that as remain in exile as of now, and lead your children there by means of Torah and good deeds. And if your good deeds will testify on your behalf, they will redeem you. As I said about a parent and a child, you earn it, great. If you don't earn it, but you're really trying your best and you still can't earn it, I'll help you along. Then I, God, will redeem you as God lives. Lie down until the morning comes and the light of redemption shines forth. Light of redemption isn't necessarily a moment. It's not the end of the movie. It's not the end of history, but it's a process that shows us that actually God was with us all along. And the closing reflections, which I want to take time for you to be able to think about, are the following. We talked about our personal risk-taking. We talked about the psychology of risk-taking. We talked about Ruth and Naomi's risks. And I want to talk about the nation, the Jewish people, the Jewish nation's sense of risk-taking. There's a popular song. I don't know where it comes from. That you can hear Jewish people singing when they are not sure what the outcome is going to be. Am ha-netzach lo mefached miderech arukah. Am ha-netzach, you translate? The people of eternity, right? People of eternity. Netzach is that attitude of certainty and eternity and knowing that God has a plan and that we're actually here for some good reason, and we're going to be here. I may not personally be here, but but we as a nation are going to be here. Lo mefached, are not afraid. Not afraid of a long journey, because we know the uncertainty, the part of what it means to be the Jewish people and to live out that plan of the divine and to be part of God's plan. It's not going to be like this. It's not from today to tomorrow. Whole long process. Why is it that way? We wish it was shorter. I know, but in my lasot, aval lo mefached, right? And what I want you to think about in our closing reflections, and we have some time to do this. I want to give you time, and then we'll bring it back together, and I'll say one thing, last couple words. On the national scheme of things, I want you to look at these questions and turn to the person next to you and try to answer them. When have the Jewish people acted with tenacity and courage, taking risks for something they believe in or to which they are committed? I don't think the whole Jewish people or groups within the Jewish people. In which area have you been amazed to see a process of evolution for the Jewish nation? And in which area have you had difficulty being patient about anticipating progress or positive development for the Jewish people? Because being in this process entails a lot of uncertainty, and we don't always understand how things and when things are going to unfold and when they're going to get better. Have there been partial resolutions or redemptions which have strengthened your sense that God works in mysterious ways to bring about a positive evolution, that's this, for the Jewish nation, and I'll add ultimately for the world, for humanity? a lot of questions there. You can focus on any of the ones that speak to you. Turn to the person next to you, and you're going to spend 10 minutes sharing your thoughts on those. Okay? And then we'll come together and continue. I got to hear a few of your brief conversations. I'm sorry I didn't get to hear everyone's. And I would love to be able to now spend another hour to just share your thoughts and ideas. We don't have time to do that, so maybe over lunch you can share some ideas with each other. You can share with each other your ideas and your closing reflections about our national process of risk-taking, believing that we are Am HaNetzach, that we have a goal, we have a vision, we have values that we're here to uphold, and at the same time the process is going to be long and uncertain, and we have to do our parts as if, when you think about like what, you know, how much does God take responsibility, how much do we take responsibility, how much is God running the show and how much are we running this show, we don't know that. We have no idea. Is it 50-50? Or is it 1%? Is it 99% and 1%? Is God really waiting for us to take responsibility and to use our everything that we have and everything that we know, right, to strategize and to do all, right? Is God really waiting for us to do those things? And I believe that we don't know, but we have to act as if God's waiting for us. Right? As if God's waiting for us to do our part. Uh-huh. And I want to finish by mentioning Hanukkah. Because Saturday night we're going to light the first candle of Hanukkah. And I want to think about, maybe like 3 minutes, and so I just want to make a mention that what are we celebrating on Hanukkah? The Talmud itself in the Gemara, it says, my Hanukkah. It doesn't ask that about other holidays. My Purim, it doesn't ask that. My Hanukkah is saying, what are we actually celebrating? Are we celebrating? Well, what do? We light candles, so what are we celebrating? What are we celebrating? When we light Hanukkah candles, what are we celebrating? What are we commemorating?
The miracle of the oil.
Oh, see, so you're calling it a low level. I don't know, but
it's the survival of the people.
That's right.
Okay, good. In other words, you're saying to us in the specifics, we're commemorating the miracle that God did where the oil, where one little cruse of oil lasted for 8 days. Right? But the cruse of oil, which naturally, and that's why we have light, why do we light eight lights of Hanukkah? Why are we lighting lights for 8 nights? Because the miracle was really only 7. The cruse of oil was natural, and then it would last for 7 more days. So the miracle was really 7, not 8. Right? But I think that we can see in the prayers, in the Amidah that we say 3 times a day, and in the Birkat HaMazon that we say however many times we've read, once or twice or 3 times a day, we say something else. We don't talk about the cruse of oil. What do we talk about? We talk about the battle. We talk about the battle that the Maccabees fought when they really said our survival, and not our physical survival, but our spiritual survival, our ability to celebrate Shabbat, our ability to
Hellenism.
Right, Hellenism. They were saying our ability to believe in one God and to maintain our values as Jewish values and not to get sucked into the Hellenistic values. That's really what we are also celebrating, the agency. And I think that's the one day. If we were celebrating 7 days of God's miracle, we are. But on the other hand, the rabbis are telling us that what we need to be talking about all the time is not what God did, but what a group of crazy Jews did. When they said, we're not going to let the Greeks forbid us from keeping Shabbat and from making circumcision, and we're not going to let that happen. We're going to take control, and we're going to fight, even though the odds were all against them. Even though the odds were entirely against them, and that's what we say in the prayers, right, that Me'atim mul Rabim, that it was really that we were the few and they were the many, that's the miracle. We could say that the miracle is that, like, God fought the war for us, but really the miracle is no less. I'm not saying it's not that, but I'm saying it's no less that we had the chutzpah. And as much as we had the chutzpah, we really had this sense of the value and the belief in what we live for, that no, we did not want to be Hellenists. No, we did not want to give up all the things that we believe are true and beautiful and important in our lives. And I just think that that's we have to think about when we celebrate Hanukkah, that we are really Am HaNetzach. Shelo mufached miderech arukah, despite the uncertainty, and we have to take our agency and do as much as we can. And I think that's when we are celebrating Hanukkah. I think that that's really what we can focus on, is the fact that God has our backs. God's with us. God has a plan on one hand. That's what the prophets tell us, and that's what the Jewish texts tell us. And on the other hand, when we don't see exactly how it's going to pan out, right, we really turn inward and say to ourselves, what do we believe in? That's what we believe in. We believe in that Netzach plan, and we're going to make it happen. Right? And when we're going to make it happen, then we are hoping and praying that God's going to be with us along the way.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.